KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you very much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture and this inaugural edition of the show for this quarter. I'm excited to be back and to continue our discussion on technology and intellectual property law. Sometimes both, sometimes one. Occasionally we go off in a different direction. Last quarter, I was very pleased to have on Wendy Seltzer and Andrew Lumen from the Tor Project talking about anonymity online, as well as a few other guests that were talking about issues of security in technology. Well, for this inaugural show for the quarter, I'm very excited to have on Ron Diebert. And Ron is the director of the Citizen Lab at the Monk Center for International Studies at the University of Toronto. I was very excited and remain very excited to have booked Ron on the show, but I booked him on the show prior to the recent report that came out of his center involving GhostNet, the cyber espionage network that Ron and his colleagues unearthed through an interesting contract that we'll talk about a bit and which has gotten a lot of attention. Today on the show, we're going to be chatting with Ron not only about GhostNet, but also about the work that he co-authored called Access Denied, a collection of essays and analyses of issues involving internet filtering and censorship in technology. We're also going to chat a bit about, towards the end of the interview, about the Obama administration, but we'll mostly focus on these issues of security and espionage and censorship of speech in technology. Now, Ron's work is very timely, but also very prescient because of the issues that we're increasingly facing as data is mined on the internet and as more and more information is made available. And one of the interesting documents that Ron's organization, Citizen Lab, which we'll also talk about, put together recently is a guide for citizens worldwide, the Everyone's Guide to Bypassing Internet Censorship for Citizens Worldwide. And it was interesting to take a look through this, and we'll talk about it a bit, because you don't often read a document where you have things to remember that include statements like, never use an out-of-country contact you do not know and trust. That's not something that we generally run into when we're dealing with technology issues, at least on a day-to-day basis. But more and more, perhaps, even the casual internet user needs to think in these terms. So although we're going to be talking about things like GhostNet, which go far beyond the casual user's use of technology, we also will be discussing this from a standpoint of people that are not immersed in technology, but that use technology on a day-to-day basis in ways that are perhaps, to put it one way, more mundane. What do consumers and what do people think about, or what should they be thinking about in light of the work that Citizen Lab has done, and in particular, in light of the very recent report the Citizen Lab put together involving GhostNet? So I am very excited, and without further introduction, I want to thank you, Ron, for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, I always ask my guests up front, and I want to ask you this question. Tell us a little bit more about your background and how you got interested in these issues.
Okay, well, let me go way back then. I started out as a graduate student interested in information technologies and international security issues. I grew up in Vancouver and did my PhD in the Department of Political Science at the University of British Columbia. And while working on my PhD, I also did some policy work for the Canadian government, specifically the Department of Foreign Affairs, Canada, looking at ways we might use satellite reconnaissance technologies for arms control verification purposes. And it may seem like a rather obscure topic, but that really piqued my interest back then in both the world of new technologies. At that time, satellite reconnaissance technologies were very obscure, often shrouded in secrecy. Certainly not like today, where you know we can go on Google Earth and see images that at the time when I was working were highly classified, among the most sensitive of all material. And also, the fact that there was this underworld of the global communications environment that very few people either understood or knew about, and in academic circles, few people were actually writing about it. So that really piqued my interest, and so while writing and thinking about the implications for world politics of new communication information technologies, I always had this long-standing interest in trying to dig beneath the surface and try to find out what could be documented and monitored that wasn't apparent to the average user of the internet. It wasn't until about the late 1990s that I hooked up with a colleague, Rafał Rohozinski, who at that time was finishing up his PhD at Cambridge University in England. He had a different life history that took him more directly in the world of intelligence and security issues and international development. And we both realized very quickly that we shared the same interests. We wanted to understand how cyberspace had become an object of geopolitical contestation. We were both interested in using methods, new methods of technical interrogation that were just then emerging to document this hidden realm. And we both at the time were actually fortunate enough to receive support from the Ford Foundation in the United States. And for me at that time, my idea was to create a laboratory, an interdisciplinary research and development lab that would bring together people from different disciplines to work on projects under my direction, mostly computer scientists and engineers, because I wanted to bring together people with the appropriate skill set that I'd lacked as a political scientist to really map this emerging terrain. And that's really how the Citizen Lab got started. And it wasn't soon after it was founded that Rafał and I teamed up to develop proposals for projects on internet censorship and surveillance and information warfare, and met up with colleagues at the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School to found something called the Open Net Initiative. And in fact, right at the same time, we launched the Information Warfare Monitor as a sister project to the Open Net Initiative. But it remained kind of on the back burner for a while we focused our efforts on the ONI.
The Citizen Lab itself, and I want to ask you a question about this, how does one who is interested in these issues, and I usually ask this at the end, but I think you've mentioned a number of resources, so I want to ask up front. You're talking about issues that, as I mentioned in the introduction, are not issues that people tend to run into on a day-to-day basis. And for those people that are attempting to make that connection, in other words, how does this impact my life? Perhaps you could tell me a little bit more about OpenNet in particular and how you relate that to the average internet user.
Well, I think for most internet users, certainly the average user, their internet experience begins with their computer screen in front of them. They send an email and it's gone, and it magically appears on their friend's BlackBerry or computer screen, or they make a request for a website and it instantly appears. And the stuff in between, so to speak, is largely a mystery, or it's taken for granted. But if you were to follow that information down the fiber optic line to the router, to the internet service provider, to the exchange point, the gateway, the undersea cables, the satellites, you'd find out that there is, first of all, a very real physical infrastructure to cyberspace that is at tension with this notion of a virtual realm we have in our mind when we think about how we inhabit and perceive cyberspace. And secondly, that physical infrastructure is actually a domain that is heavily contested. And there are many choke points inside that domain where authorities and actors, be it states or corporations or criminal organizations or even individuals, can intervene and either block access to information or monitor communications. And this has been going on for a long time. It's just that most people are unaware of it. And I think now with reports like GhostNet and the work of the Open Net Initiative, whose aim was to document patterns of internet filtering, awareness is growing about what happens beneath the surface of the internet.
Let's talk initially about GhostNet, because that's been gotten heavy press recently, and I think it's something that is a good way to talk about these issues in a concrete way before we speak generally about internet censorship. So I know that you've done this countless times, so I'll ask you, what is the general background on GhostNet? What is it, and very, at a top level, how does it work?
Well, GhostNet is a name we coined to give to the system, the network of apparent cyber espionage that we uncovered. And probably the best way to understand it is by tracing and following the kind of narrative of how the research unfolded. We began our investigations among Tibetan communities in exile, in particular the private offices of the Dalai Lama, and other Tibetan groups who had long suspected that their computers were compromised in various ways. They had anecdotal evidence to suggest that they were being spied upon. And so one of our researchers, Greg Walton, who has had a long relationship with the Tibetans and happened to be in the field giving them advice and engaged in consultation on this issue, started up the research by monitoring their communications using some network monitoring systems, and from that determined that indeed their systems were thoroughly compromised. When he finished his field investigations, which included offices in a number of countries where Tibetan groups are located, in New York, Brussels, London, and elsewhere, we archived the data and brought back to the Citizen Lab and began the second half of our investigation, which consisted of data mining and analysis and technical scouting, as we call it, which means simply using interrogation tools and other network monitoring systems to engage in a kind of forensic analysis of the internet and some of the evidence that we retrieve from the field investigations. And that was led up by Nart Villeneuve, who's a very creative, amazing researcher at the Citizen Lab. In fact, he's been with us from the beginning. And he managed to locate the control servers that were used to compromise the computers and control them among the Tibetan organizations. And he found out that, in fact, the control servers that he located were set up in an insecure manner. They weren't password protected, in other words.
Amazing.
So he was allowed to simply access, browse, and archive all of the command and control servers we eventually found. And when we took a close look, we realized that we had a infected system that comprised much more than just the Tibetan organizations. There were many high-profile targets, meaning government ministries, embassies, diplomatic missions, and NGOs, and media, businesses, and so forth, most of which seem to have strategic significance to Chinese foreign and security policy. So in other words, what we had stumbled upon was not your average botnet, which usually is a network of randomly infected nodes. Here we had something that appeared to be much more targeted and narrowly confined. And so we eventually infected a honeypot computer, as we call them, or as it's known in the security business, which means setting up a trap, in essence, a computer that you set up to be deliberately infected by one of the Trojans. And when we did that, we realized that one of the main tools that the attackers were using was something called GhostRat, which is a Chinese-developed software tool that allows remote control access of computers that are infected with this particular Trojan. And it's a quite powerful tool. It allows the attacker to essentially control all aspects of the machine, to view all of the documents, to put in place a system for monitoring all keystrokes that are made on the computer, to open up and control audio and video capture and picture capture systems that may be on the computer. So in effect, turning compromised computers into real-time listening devices or bugs wherever they may be located. So a very powerful tool. And because of the centrality of the Ghostrat tool to the whole network, we termed the network GhostNet. And there was another reason as well, and this really hasn't been talked about much, but we also called it GhostNet because among the group of researchers who were involved in this, we realized that although circumstantial evidence seems to point to China, one of the characteristics of attacks of this sort is that they can be launched from virtually anywhere. And in reality, although the circumstantial evidence is very strong, we cannot say with certainty that this was an attack carried out by the Chinese government itself. It mm-hmm. could be a number of other actors. There are a number of plausible explanations, and I think that's one of the more interesting aspects of our research.
You know, it's and I want to press on that point as well. Before we get to it, however, I think it's important to note that what you're talking about here is a network that not only targeted the Dalai Lama, which you discover, but also ran into a range of computers ranging from embassies to NGOs to international organizations. You know, in looking at the data in terms of what this network is doing, aside from the Dalai Lama targeting, what, in your view, is its major target, putting aside the Tibetans?
Well, it seems to be what we call high-value targets, meaning political and economic targets, that are mostly located or related to South and Southeast Asia and have some strategic significance to China. So in our report, we write about the nodes as if they're spread across an arc running through the southern border of China, from the mountains of India, where Tibetan organizations are located, to Bhutan, to Malaysia, Taiwan, and Hong Kong, and so forth. Organizations that were located further afield nonetheless had real significance to China. For example, the Indian embassy in Washington, D.C. is thoroughly compromised. Military attachés, assistance to ambassadors, their computers were completely taken over. Associated Press offices were compromised. Major accounting firms are compromised. And in fact, we're still, to this day, analyzing some of the data that we've collected since publishing our report to find new targets that we didn't list in our original report. Of course, there are ones that don't seem to have much significance to China directly, and it's, again, part of the reason why we have to be careful pointing fingers. But certainly, circumstantially, these appear to be a collection of targets that are of very high strategic significance for China.
The honeypot concept is one that we also see in espionage generally, and you know the history of luring spies and people doing that work by bringing in the honeypot, which you know historically has often been someone who could lure the individual for sexual favors and so forth. And here we're talking about, of course, honeypot in a different context, but you're talking about setting up this dummy in order to figure out exactly what's happening with the GhostNet and with the GhostRat interface. When you mention using GhostRat and, in fact, being able to control these computers from anywhere, I do want to press on that a little bit and ask this question, which I think is a logical one. Is it the case that any person or any computer that is able to access this GhostRat interface would then have the same controls as anyone else? In other words, is there anything special about these control servers that is different than any other laptop computer that any individual might own?
Well, it's a good question. There are a number of command and control servers, and we were limited in terms of what we could do by ethical strict restrictions that are placed around the parameters of our research activities. So it's important to emphasize that we didn't break into anything, or certainly not break the law in what we did. We just browsed and monitored and archived what we saw in front of us through a browser, essentially. That is on the documentation of the GhostNet command and control servers. We set up a honeypot computer, which allowed us to infer the capabilities from the tool that was being used. So once we were infected, we could see exactly what the attacker was doing in real time, and they didn't spend much time on our honeypot computer, but we knew what tool they were using, and so we could then get the tool ourselves and play with it under laboratory conditions and see what its full range of capabilities are. In fact, I would urge people to take a look at an interesting video that the company Symantec just put up online yesterday that goes through in a very clear way how the GhostRat tool operates and how simple it is to use. It's got a very nice graphical user interface. It's nicely translated into English. So it's a very powerful tool. When it comes to network monitoring that happened in the field, of course, we had the consent of Tibetan organizations there, so it was a bit different. But certainly there was a line we could have crossed once we had control that would have given us at least many of the capabilities that the attacker had.
We're talking
that
with
would be wrong.
Yes, and which gets, of course, to the ethics of hacktivism and the kind of work that your work touches on.
Right.
And it's one that's always interesting to probe.
And this is also why, just to underscore this point, we issued a redacted version of the report. There are parts of the report that are blacked out, which is a curious thing for someone like me personally to be on. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, I had been an observer and a scholar of the world of intelligence for a long time, and here I am now issuing a redacted report myself.
Uh-huh.
That was precisely to protect the affected targets from further compromise.
We're talking with Ron Diebert, the director of Citizen Lab at the Monk Center for International Studies at the University of Toronto. Ron, you know, you mentioned that this is an ongoing project, and perhaps you could tell us what your next steps are in terms of entities that have reached out to you and where you're looking to go to expand this, because you do mention in the report the logical statement, which is that you've uncovered one network, but there's no reason to think that there aren't more out there, and in fact, there probably are.
Yeah, well, in the immediate future, we've, once the hurricane of attention passed, we have focused our attention on doing a job of outreach, and that alone has been an interesting experience because, among other things, what this case demonstrates is that there is an immature system of international notification for this sort of activity. When we realized what we had in our hands, one of the things we thought amongst our group was, well, what do we do? How do we notify all of these targets? Do we actually phone them ourselves? I mean, it would be probably impractical and raise all sorts of further questions. There was one point I can recall looking at the phone number of one of the infected targets at an embassy I won't name, and thinking, you know, I could pick up the phone right now and talk to this person and tell them that their computer is compromised. But after the report came out, we got just flooded with calls from, you know, diplomatic missions and embassies, wondering, you know, how can we identify the computers that have been compromised? And so what we've done now is turn over the information to essentially the Canadian Computer Emergency Response Team here in Canada, who is leading up the process of outreach to affected parties. And we're working alongside them. So once we had released our report publicly, we wanted to turn it over to the relevant authorities. so that notification could happen. But it illustrates to me really a major policy issue, and that's that, first of all, cyberspace has become increasingly militarized. It's something that I've been saying personally for a long time. And secondly, that international security mechanisms around cyberspace policy are very immature. Most of the attention around cyberspace security has to do with securing critical infrastructures, and that's very important. But here we have cyber espionage occurring, and most governments around the world have developed doctrines for fighting and winning wars in cyberspace, and presumably that would include the sort of thing that we uncovered, which is why, again, we said in our report and elsewhere that China's not alone here. There are other countries that are presumably engaging in this sort of thing, and GhostNet's not the first or only one of its kind. So it begs the question for me what to do internationally. Should we be thinking about something like cyberspace arms control? And if so, what would that look like? I'm frankly a little discouraged by some recent proposals around cybersecurity that suggest a very heavy hand and centralized responses involving intelligence agencies and so on that I think are inappropriate and don't suit both the problem and the nature of internet communications. In other words, I think we want to preserve what's good about the internet while securing it. We don't want to destroy the internet to protect it, and I fear that people may come to some rash conclusions about what needs to be done in light of this and other incidences like it. So that's where we're focused now on a kind of policy level in terms of international responses. But the Information Warfare Monitor is a project that's very vital. It's where a lot of our efforts are focused these days at the Citizen Lab, and we're excited about some of the new methods we're using that were demonstrated in that particular report, but also in a previous one where we uncovered a massive surveillance system on the Skype software system, the Chinese version of Skype. So we're trying to pick and choose cases to investigate using a combination of field investigations and technical scouting and data analysis.
We're talking with Ron Diebert, the director of the Citizen Lab at the Monk Center for International Studies at the University of Toronto, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation or underwriting KZSU, you have a couple of ways to contact the station. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or alternatively, you can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu. And you do not need Ghost Rat to do this. You can actually just go directly to the page and click on Donate to KZSU. And either way, we do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU and continue to enjoy KZSU's programming. So, you know, Ron, let's talk a little bit about that idea and transition a bit into the other major focus of today's discussion, which is your co-authored book, Access Denied. You mentioned an interesting point that I wanted to get to, which is, and I've heard people in policy positions do this, of course. The view is, or a view is, that the internet is a den of thieves. And obviously there's a lot of bad activity going on the internet. We know the extreme versions involving things like child pornography. But this is something which, as you mentioned at the beginning, is maybe a new consideration, and definitely now a concrete consideration for policymakers. As someone who has spent a career studying these issues of security and really identifying the things that we should be concerned about, I mean, that there's no debate that we as citizens in a free republic should be concerned when we have cyber espionage operating that's breaking into computers all around the globe for reasons that we can't clearly identify. How do you respond to policymakers who would say to you, Ron, your work proves that we need to have a heavy hand, that all of these nice ideas about open architecture and exchange of information should go the way of the dodo when you discover something like GhostNet? How do you respond to that?
Well, there are a lot of responses in that, actually, and it's an excellent series of questions. I guess I begin from a different set of assumptions than a lot of people in the national security communities, whether it's in the United States or Canada or Europe or wherever, and that is, I begin with the assumption that the internet or cyberspace, whatever you want to call it, is a valuable thing, and it's something that's going to become more important as we look ahead decades from now. We live in an increasingly finite global political space. It seems to be more compressed every day, and we have, as citizens of this planet, so many shared problems, whether it's environment or poverty or disease, that require solutions. And in order for there to be solutions, citizens need to be able to communicate with each other, share ideas, exchange information. And for better or for worse, the internet is the medium through which we do that. And the way it's been set up, which allows for end-user ingenuity and creativity from the endpoints, is a wonderful thing. And sure, it has major security problems, and certainly security wasn't built into the design of the network. That doesn't mean that we have to destroy it in order to save it. And I think from the perspective of many national security planners, the knee-jerk reaction is to centralized, hierarchical responses that usually mean secrecy and closure. Take the issue of open architectures and open source. Along with many other people, I believe that the best way to ensure security is precisely through open architectures and open source, so that many more eyeballs are on the code underlying the architecture and the software that we use. I also think it's very important from a human rights perspective that we promote open source software so that we can see what's going on beneath the surface. And that was aptly illustrated in my mind by the Skype project that the report I talked about that we released in the fall. If users were able to see the code, we would have been able to know exactly what was going on. In fact, it wouldn't have happened if there was open source software being used. So openness ensures security, and I guess it's a different way of looking at what is the object of security. For someone coming at it from a national security perspective, the object of security is the state, and the infrastructure is secondary or subordinate to the security of the state. Whereas for me, I'm thinking about securing human rights online, securing access to information, freedom of speech, the circulation of ideas. So for me, security has a different object and a different set of policy prescriptions. I think that rather than, as there's a bill that's being proposed in your country that's received a lot of publicity over the last few days, coming from Rockefeller and Snow, I think rather than something like what they're proposing, which is wrong-headed in a number of ways, we need to think about solutions that suit the architecture of the internet that we want to protect and preserve. And that means, I think, more decentralized responses, de-securitizing a lot of responses. In other words, rather than throwing things in the hands of organizations that are by definition inherently secretive and bureaucratic and hierarchical, we need to open them up to civil organizations. For example, computer emergency response teams that have been set up in countries around the world are unused vehicles for security information sharing. The international connections between them are there, but they're embryonic and they need to be further developed. So if I was to promote specific policies, that's where I might begin, is by beefing up the information sharing among national certs and making sure that they remain civilian organizations. To me, they can become prototypes in a kind of global early warning information security system, much like the type of systems one has seen being proposed for monitoring of nuclear arms control, for example. So I guess the way I look at security is, I guess to borrow analogy, more like traditional Republican political theory, checks and balances and separation of power, rather than the concentration of power in a single hand.
The security through transparency concept is one that is of particular interest to me as I write in issues of transparency and government operations. And so our interests dovetail there, and I think it leads us into a further discussion regarding your work, Access Denied, which, as I mentioned in the introduction, is a collection of works by a variety of experts in the field, including some who have been previously on the show and others that I hope to have on the show in the future. Access Denied focuses on broadly on issues of censorship of speech and of access information in technology, which, of course, is another way that states can go about attempting to either subvert and or control the technology that otherwise could be used in the cases that you focus on oftentimes to undermine the control of the state. In Access Denied, I think you draw some interesting dichotomies, which I do want to explore. In the particular chapter that you authored with your colleague Rafael Rozinski, Global Civil Society and the Securitization of the Internet, you focus on this concept of the civil society, which again is one that I think you've referred to as something you come back to as you think about security. How do you define, and I know you use definitions from elsewhere, so I don't want to spend a ton of time on it, but how do you define civil society? In more particular, within that civil society, you draw certain distinctions between different types of uses of technology within it. So perhaps you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's been a long-standing hypothesis, I guess you could say, among political scientists and observers of international relations that the Internet and cyberspace has contributed to the explosive growth of citizen networks around the world, which is usually formulated as global civil society, meaning those open associative networks that individuals form of their own accord to network around shared ideas and shared political visions or causes. And, you know, the classic examples are big NGOs like Amnesty International and Greenpeace, but of course there have been tens of thousands of these around the world that are, you know, local grassroots organizations and small nonprofit groups and so on. And it's kind of a truism to say that the Internet has helped propel this explosive growth of these organizations. But often overlooked is the fact that civic organizations, groups of citizens acting together for political purposes, can include groups with more nefarious causes that aren't necessarily what we'd think of as being progressive, at least from a kind of a leftist political discourse in the United States or Canada. So in other words, extremists, militants, terrorist groups, and so on, what we call in that chapter you refer to as dark or resistance networks. Now, what we did in that chapter was focus particularly on efforts by states around the world to target the Internet as a way to limit the capabilities of dark and resistance networks and how those controls end up stifling civil society networks. And I think a good example relates, in fact, to one of your previous shows, is the way in which states have targeted technologies online that are used by groups to protect their privacy or engage in anonymous communications or use technologies that get around internet filtering. Mm-hmm. Many countries around the world routinely block access to that type of technology as a way to try to stifle legitimate civic opposition or challenges from darker resistance networks. And I think that's growing in part because many of the countries that we're studying use commercial filtering products that make it much easier for these countries to simply check off categories of content like that they don't want their citizens to access.
the use of this these varieties of filtering technologies that you discuss in your chapter, including a just-in-time blocking, the idea of knocking out specific sources of information at specific times, or denial of service attacks, or other types of attacks, are identified, at least in your chapter, as being done primarily by countries that we consider to be repressive, and you know they run a range from somewhat more notorious states like Uzbekistan and Myanmar to major powers like China, Iran, and so forth. And I'm wondering, you know, in connection with GhostNet, do you envision that the revelation, the public revelation of a network like GhostNet could be used by countries that we don't typically view as repressive? Certainly, again, the list of countries that you identify in your chapter, none of them really come as surprises that they would in one way or another being attempt to filter internet access or communications. But do you see GhostNet as expanding the efforts of states across the board to consider filtering?
I suppose it could be a lesson I'd consider improperly derived from that report. I would, and I can see it happening, that's for sure, where policymakers and special interests seize upon our report to justify further military encroachments or intelligence encroachments into cyberspace or infringements on privacy or enhancements to filtering, whereas I would see it kind of in the opposite sense. For example, as we mentioned in our report, many countries engage in this type of activity. It's now considered frontline doctrine for military organizations to have very advanced cyber warfare capabilities, including computer network operations of the type that we outline. Rather than further accelerating those, I would rather see that governments are restrained, that laws are passed that that set parameters around what is acceptable internationally to prevent this sort of thing from happening. And, of course, that could only happen through greater oversight, something that's been lost certainly since 9/11, where intelligence agencies have been allowed to dig deeper into the digital environment of cyberspace, collect information often outside of the framework of the rule of law. So the pendulum has to swing back in my mind, and greater restraint has to be imposed on those organizations. Greater oversight has to come from civilians. And in the area of filtering, unfortunately, many more countries now are engaged in filtering and justifying it for a variety of reasons, not just national security reasons, but also blocking access to pornography. Recently, there was a proposal in Australia, for example, for a national filtering system, ostensibly to block access to pornography, but it raised some very serious public policy questions in that country, and eventually the legislation was defeated, but it shows the scope of this issue, that countries like Australia, like Canada, like the United Kingdom are debating or implementing national filtering schemes. So the internet is being carved up in ways that certainly weren't there before, and those of us who care about internet communications don't want to see happen further.
We're talking with Ron Diebert, the director of the Citizen Lab at the Monk Center for International Studies at the University of Toronto, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. Ron, we have about 10 minutes left, and I want to ask you about something. Perhaps it sounds extreme, but it's something to think about. Historically, say historically in internet terms, so I'm thinking maybe the last 15 years, we've generally had the view that it is impossible to rein in all forms of communication on the internet. But slowly, as technologies advance, there's more and more capability, as your report indicates, as work like Professor Paul Ohms from the University of Colorado has written about recently, involving the ability of ISPs to monitor all traffic that come through their networks. Increasingly, the technology does seem to allow for vast quantities of data, far more than were previously imagined possible, to be monitored and controlled. So I guess I'll ask you the logical question. You mentioned that in your report and in your writings that it would would be impossible to fully rein in the internet. And I can certainly see that given technology today, but given where we're headed, and this is, of course, a crystal ball question, which is always unfair, but is it inconceivable that technology in terms of the ability to filter, to control, take over zombie computers as GhostNet has done, couldn't eventually lead to that point? Is that an impossibility from your standpoint of where technology seems to be headed?
Well, anything's possible. All technologies are socially constructed, but I do think there are some countervailing forces, and above all else, there is the ingenuity of users at endpoints of the network who are continually creating new software systems or new tools or new methods that defy attempts by governments to control. On the other hand, the capabilities of organizations to engage in data mining and analysis and fusing different traces of digital information from different sources together to create actionable intelligence is really quite powerful today. And I think what explains the sea change is not so much the fact that the internet has changed, although it has, of course, over the last couple of decades, it's that governments have woken up, and there have been major policy changes. So policy changes that remove restrictions on what data can be collected, how it can be collected, who it can be shared with. Policy changes that promote the ability to engage in active operations, offensive operations in cyberspace, mostly by military organizations. Governments realizing that they can pressure the major choke points, and by that I mean internet service providers, to do a proxy job of policing for them. It's not that the internet service providers have new technologies per se, although they do have new systems that are continually developed to monitor traffic. It's that they're being pressured to from a variety of arenas. So, for example, with the Cybercrime Convention, to which many states are a party, that convention places some major onuses on internet service providers to collect and retain data that flows through their pipes, something that is in contradiction to the early original architectural principles for internet communications, but it's coming very powerfully from the law enforcement community. And at the same time, there are pressures in the very same direction from commercial interests and from a copyright perspective, protecting intellectual property, and also at the same time for economic reasons having to do with bandwidth throttling. So there are converging policy pressures on internet service providers to open up the packets that flow through their networks and monitor them and route them according to priorities that are laid out to them for either economic or security purposes. And that's really something that has happened not for technological reasons so much as political reasons. And anything that happens for political reasons can be changed or restrained in some manner through politics again. So I think it's up to us citizens in our local communities, starting locally first, to begin working towards legislation that protects access to information, that protects privacy, that protects freedom of speech, that restricts what law enforcement intelligence can do within reason, that limits what internet service providers can do and what private companies can do with our data. It's up to us to initiate those proposals and laws locally and work towards their spread internationally if we want to protect and preserve the internet as a forum for free expression.
Ron, we have about 5 minutes left, and I should mention for listeners that this show is being recorded on April 8th to be aired on April 15th. I'm headed to a conference, in fact, on the 15th when the show airs at the University of Maryland, dealing with fusion centers expanded in the United States in efforts through the Department of Justice in the United States to figure out who might be criminals and terrorists and so forth. And of course, there are concerns about transparency and privacy and so forth that we're focusing on. Do you see, and you mentioned this answer, do you see Western democracies taking the combination of the ability to filter and GhostNet and practically going in the direction that would fundamentally change the operations of the internet itself? Consumers can do quite a bit, and users can do quite a bit to advocate for policies. But because of the nature of the technology itself, because it's complex, because not a lot of people understand it, which is part of a goal of Hearsay Culture, is to educate people. That's the major goal of the show. Do you envision that Western democracies would go in this direction in light of a greater understanding of what the technology can and cannot do? It's an easy one to guess and predict for a country like Uzbekistan, for example. But what would you say about Canada and the United States? If you pull out that crystal ball, where are we going to be in 5 years in terms of security versus openness?
Well, I think there are major pressures to filter internet traffic, primarily for reasons of wanting to control pornography. And I think that filtering presents a simple solution for a complex problem, and policymakers like the idea of something simple that they can put forth that seems to take care of a problem, even though in reality, in this case, with filtering, it doesn't. It usually creates more problems than it solves. Real solutions, such as, for example, giving more power and authority to law enforcement to take down child pornography, we all find offensive. Just too messy and complex, and so filtering is a knee-jerk reaction. And I think in the area of surveillance, one of the things that many people have remarked upon with respect to the new Obama administration that they found surprising, and certainly it's an area that hasn't represented change from the previous administration, is in the area of wiretapping and surveillance. This certainly seems to be one policy front that the Obama administration aggressively agrees with the Bush administration. And I would say, you know, where the Obama administration goes, our country here, Canada, will probably go along with as well. So the momentum is definitely in the direction of filtering and greater surveillance. And then if you look in the military spheres, there is a huge burgeoning sector around cybersecurity, and both in the private industry, companies that are seeking to capitalize on scares, cybersecurity scares, but also within the military itself, which is hoping to reorient its mission, or at least part of its mission, towards cyberspace, towards exercising power in cyberspace, which is, of course, a natural evolution of military thinking. But when doctrine talks openly about fighting and winning wars in cyberspace, I think citizens around the world have to take note and try to understand what's going on. So those are three major forces right now, and that doesn't even include what's going on in the area of intellectual property protection and digital rights management and so
right.
on. You know, the trends right now are quite worrisome for me, but that's precisely why we do the work that we do, to try to raise awareness about these issues and hope that individuals can, through their elected officials, create and pass laws that restrict what military, intelligence, and commercial interests can do online.
Ron Deibert, director of the Citizen Lab at the Monk Center for International Studies at the University of Toronto. It's fascinating work you've done, Ron, and I certainly congratulate you and your colleagues at Citizen Lab for your work on GhostNet and also OpenNet, which I'm a big fan of. For those people that are not familiar, perhaps very quickly, the web addresses for your organizations where people can learn more about these issues.
I would say go to citizenlab.org.
Beautiful. Ron, thank you so much for being on the show today. Thanks for taking the time, and certainly I invite you back on the show at a future date to continue the discussion. But thank you for taking the time here to chat with my listeners.
Thanks very much, Dave. I appreciate it.
I'm very excited about the list of guests that I have coming up, not only for this quarter, but going into the summer as well. Among those guests, and you can always find a list of all of these guests by going to hearsayculture.com and clicking on schedule. But I'm excited to mention that we will have on Professor Gordon Hull from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, who writes in the area of philosophy and ethics and technology, an apropos topic in light of our discussion today with Ron Deibert. Professor Alex Halavay, author of the book Search Engine Society, will be on as well. Geert Lovink will be on discussing his book Zero Comments, as well as other work in the area of internet architecture and philosophy. Cassius Varnellis will be on the show as well. Professor John Kunisch will be on, a colleague of mine at Charlotte School of Law, and an unusual guest because he will be talking more about the writing side of technology and his work writing on these issues and thinking about this from an author's standpoint. So I'm excited to have John on, who does a lot of interesting work in a variety of areas. Susan Marrott will be on the show discussing her compendium of work on government secrecy. Siva Vaidyanathan from the University of Virginia will be on later in the year discussing his work, The Googleization of Everything. Professor Michael Heller will be on the show from Columbia, as well as Professor Gary Small discussing his book, iBrain. Professor John Taranian from Chapman University will be on discussing his book, Whitewashed, and Technology and the Minority Community, and some of the work that he's been doing there. Michael Geist will be on the show discussing copyright law from the perspective of the Canadian community that's writing in this area. Professor Jamie Boyle from Duke University School of Law will be on discussing his recent book, The Public Domain. Professor Mark Lemley from Stanford and Dan Burke from UC Irvine will be on the show as well discussing their forthcoming book on patent law reform. Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation will be on the show as well. And last but certainly not least, Professor Paul Heald from the University of Georgia will be on the show in a few weeks discussing his work in intellectual property as well. For those of you that want to get the show in a variety of ways, you can, of course, and the main way to listen is by going to KZSU in the Bay Area at 90.1 or by streaming the show at kzsulive.stanford.edu Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Alternatively, you can get the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can find all of the previous shows, as well as a list of upcoming guests and occasional blog entries. You can get the show through the Center for Internet Societies webpage in iTunes, as well as through the Center for Internet Societies webpage on the Internet at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Thanks again for listening today. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and I will talk to you next week.